Okay, let's calm down for just a minute. But well, we have about 50 people online right now. And so I want to welcome everybody this morning to the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. We call ourselves AXOL sometimes, which is not like an axle on a truck, but ACSOL. And sometimes we just refer to ourselves as the Alliance. So we welcome you here today. My name is Janice Bellucci, and I'm executive director of the organization, as well as its founder. And in addition to that, I am an attorney. So some people say I have a checkered past, and perhaps I do. Before I became a lawyer, I was a newspaper reporter. So joining us today is Chance Oberstein, and he is president of the board of directors of AXOL. Chance, would you like to introduce yourself further?
Well, other than just to say good morning and welcome to our meeting, and let's proceed.
Excellent. So, first things first, this meeting's being recorded. I think before you clicked that you wanted to join the meeting, you were told, you were informed that the meeting is recorded, but I just want to remind you that it's being recorded. The reason we record the meetings, quite frankly, is that we want not everybody can, in fact, be here in real time to listen to these meetings, to participate in the meetings. So the meetings get recorded, and they are, in fact, available on the AXOL website. So why don't I go ahead and give you the AXOL website address in case you don't have it, which is www and then dot the word all, ALL, the number 4, con, con. SOLaws.org. So all four con SOLaws.org is the website. And then you'll see we will, in fact, have in the upper right-hand corner, there's always a continuing box there, for lack of a better term, that talks about meetings and such. And right there, it will have a link to this and all the past meetings as well. So if you ever miss a meeting, please don't be overly concerned. You can, in fact, listen to these monthly meetings after the fact. Having said that, if you're listening after the fact, of course, you don't get to ask a question of Chance and I. So let's go ahead and get started. There's lots of news to report, though I'm trying to think of the one headline. That's my former newspaper reporter is like, what's the news peg? Or if you watch the TV news these days, they're always telling you there's breaking news. So I think the breaking news for us is that we did, in fact, file a new lawsuit this past week. It was on February 14th, and it was against the Attorney General of California. So I like to think of it as we sent the Attorney General Valentine. And the Valentine was this brand new lawsuit, and basically telling him how he's made a big mistake here and continues to making a big mistake, in that there are people who were convicted of Penal Code Section 288.2. And Chance, maybe you can tell people off the top of your head what the title that is. It's sharing material with a minor, I believe. And
Sending harmful material to a minor.
thank you. That's the word I was looking for, harmful. And so that in California is a wobbler offense, which means that it can be a felony reduced to a misdemeanor and under the right circumstances. And so when in California, this is the legal argument in the lawsuit, I'll just make it, that in fact, when you have a felony reduced to misdemeanor in California, it's a misdemeanor for all purposes. And the fact is that California Department of Justice is not treating this offense as a misdemeanor. Again, those that the felony is reduced to a misdemeanor. And the big difference in this, okay, so people who are convicted of 288.2 and they're still a felony to 288.2 conviction, those folks get assigned to the highest tier, which is tier three, whereas people who were convicted of a misdemeanor 288.2, guess what? They don't have to register at all. So what's happening in California is a group of people are being told that they're on the highest tier possible in California, which, by the way, puts you on lifetime registry, which means there's no way that you can petition for removal. So, I mean, this is a really dramatic difference. So we filed the lawsuit this past week on Valentine's Day. Actually, we were planning to file it the Friday before that, and then we found out the courts weren't open on that Friday. So I'm So instead, we filed it on Monday. And as I said, it was a Valentine from us to the Attorney General of California. So so that's the breaking news, everybody, that this new lawsuit was filed. By the way, we do have a pending lawsuit, too. And the pending lawsuit has to do with folks convicted of 280C, which is lewd lascivious acts with somebody who's 14 or 15 years old. And part of our legal claim is it's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of both the state and federal constitutions, because people who are convicted of the same conduct with a younger victim are being assigned to a lower tier. So that makes no sense to me. I hope it doesn't make sense to you either. And most of all, I hope it doesn't make sense to the judge. So that case is pending. The 288C case is pending, and the trial court judge granted a demurrer, which is like a motion to dismiss the case. And we weren't surprised because it was a case of first impression, and trial court judges, quite frankly, don't like to make hard decisions. They'd rather kick it upstairs to their appellate court, right? So that's where we are in the 288C case. And I don't need to talk about all the other lawsuits that we have pending, but I do want to tell you that we will be talking about litigation, future litigation in SORNA. So that is it's an almost newsflash, right? Because it hasn't happened yet, but something that's we expect to happen pretty darn soon. So we have about 70 people now participating. So let's go ahead and take a vote. The main topics that we're planning to discuss today are SORNA regulations, ALI, the American Law Institute's revised model penal code, the military issue about military retirees being denied access to bases, and then, of course, the tiered registry law here in California. So why don't we just go ahead and take a vote on it, and we'll try to do it in relatively in the order of people's interest, though I think chance keeping the tiered registry law to the end makes the most sense. I know we have people from many different states on the phone right now with us, and I think the tiered registry law is probably of limited interest to folks who don't live in California. Okay, so let's go ahead. If you're interested in the topic of SORNA regulations, would you please raise your hand? In order to raise your hand, you know, you need to go down to the reactions button, or you can literally raise your hand and can look at you. Whatever it is, makes more sense. It's easier for you to do. Yeah, why use technology? We can use good old-fashioned eyesight. Okay, so people are still voting. Yeah, keep your hand up if you would, Scott, and the other gentleman here. Okay, I think I have a good sense of how many people are interested in that topic, about 22. If you're interested in the AI, please lower your hand then so we can vote again, because the next topic here is about the ALI revised model penal code. We do have some updated information about that, what's going on with ALI and their leadership. So if you're interested in the ALI revised model penal code, please raise your hand. And you can do it again, either by using the reactions button below or by raising your hand. Yeah, there we go. Okay. All right. That seems to have a slightly greater interest in a level. So about 25 people. And then let's go to, so please lower your hand. And then let's talk about military retirees. Folks, again, who either are retirees themselves or maybe dependents of retirees. And, you know, folks right now are being denied access to military bases because of this new policy that the military has. So, again, if you're interested in the issue about military bases denying people on the registry and even possibly their dependents, go ahead and raise your hand. And we've got, you know, through reactions or through good old-fashioned hands. And I see, okay, that's about the third level of interest. Okay, we only ask you these questions because we want to do it in order of level of interest. And, you know, of course, there's no requirement for you to join us for the entire meeting. But if you do, we're happy to have you here. And if you wanted to listen to this later, of course, you can, because, of course, this whole meeting is being recorded. Okay, so let's talk about ALI first. ALI is the American Law Institute. And so the ALI put together a revised model penal code, which hadn't happened for 50 years. So it's really had been 50 years since ALI had weighed in on model penal codes. And so they said, and, you know, they're a very distinguished group of legal scholars, attorneys, judges, even some state court justices and state Supreme Court justices, that is. And so they said, you know what, it's time for us to look at this. They said that about 10 years ago. And then they spent nine years basically trying to figure out how the model penal code should be changed. You know, what's happened in the last 50 years and, you know, what's out of date, what doesn't make sense given the current circumstances, et cetera. So I'm saying that because I want you all to know this was not just, you know, some person said, oh, I have this big idea, let's do this. And then, you know, was able to cram through craft a model penal code and then ask the membership to vote on it. So ALI's members did vote on this revised model penal code, and they did so in June of last year. So we're talking about 8 months ago. So 8 months ago, ALI basically said, their membership said, yes, overwhelmingly, yes, we want this revised model penal code. And the reason that we're so interested in their revised model penal code is it really would dramatically change the, you know, what's going on in with regard to registries. It would significantly limit who has to be on the registry. I mean, significantly reduce the number of people, number of offenses that would qualify for registration. It would basically make the registry available to law enforcement only, no longer available to the public, and some other wonderful aspects of it. So the leadership, and they call themselves the council, the ALI council was to vote on the revised model penal code in January of this year. And quite frankly, a lot of people thought it was just that the council would rubber stamp it. But unfortunately, some really significant things happened in between June and January. So one of them is a letter that was signed by the attorneys general of 37 different states. So 37 different state AGs signed a letter saying we oppose the revised model penal code. Well, as you can imagine, that got ALI's attention. That's 2/3 of the states, roughly. So got that happened. And then we understand maybe even the night before the ALI council was to consider the revised model penal code, that the U.S. Department of Justice weighed in a letter and said they opposed the revised model penal code as well. Haven't seen that letter. Chance, have you seen that letter by any chance?
No, haven't seen it.
Yeah, but one of our board members who is an ALI member told us about this Department of Justice letter. And so it just basically, I think, paralyzed the ALI council members. And they're like, oh my goodness, you know, we need to think again before we adopt this. By the way, this is the interesting thing. Even when ALI approves the council approves the revised model penal code, that doesn't automatically make it law anywhere. Okay, all it does is it's a recommendation from a very from an organization that's thought of very highly throughout the country, and it would certainly help it get adopted, but it's not a guarantee in any states or the federal government. So. Still, they hesitated. So now the new date is March 3rd. So the ALI Council now, and you can write that on your calendar if you want, on March 3rd is in fact supposed to consider the revised model penal code. And Chance, I don't know if you want to chime in at this point in time and maybe share something what our board member Catherine said.
Well, not necessarily what Catherine said, but you know, just to reemphasize that these are proposals and that, you know, they're proposals of what ought to be, not what is. You know, we're dealing with what is. They are what ought to be. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, everything today is so politicized. So is the ALI. And, you know, a group of prosecutors have opposed it. And there are those. Let's just say the ALI, in terms of what Catherine explained to us, is polarized. You know, some think that, you know, there must be a registry. Some think there must be an abolishment of the registry. And there are those in between. The fact of the matter is that, you know, these proposals are smart proposals based on solid scientific evidence and facts. Okay. And so there really should be no dispute, but in essence, because we live in the time we live in, there is. And it's you know, I'm not sure that it's even likely that, you know, some of these recommendations will survive. But even if they do, the best of the best are proposals that we can certainly talk about and lobby on if they come into effect. But, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not these things are going to happen now.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Chance just said. And, you know, in California, the California governor actually has a committee, and it's been in existence now for 2 years, a committee on revising the state's penal code. I mean, what a beautiful opportunity we have, right? That, in fact, if we had this ALI revised model penal code, we could take it to the committee and say, look, this is what all these people who are very knowledgeable, who've spent 9 years studying this, have to say. And gosh, gee whiz, you know, won't you give it due consideration? And by the way, one of the provisions in the revised model penal code, which would make such a huge difference for a lot of people, is in fact that nobody would be on the registry for more than 15 years. 15 years would be the maximum time on a registry. 15. It would be automatic, the removal. There wouldn't be, you know, like what Chance and I are doing now, helping people petition for removal from the registry. It would just be automatic. And by the way, a lot of people could, in fact, petition after 10 years, again, under the revised model penal code. So this would be make such a huge, huge difference. And but you know what? First things first. So the ALI Council needs to approve it, because I can't imagine we're going to take it, you know, California to our governor's office and say, here it is. Oh, by the way, ALI's own council wouldn't approve this, but we think you should adopt it. That would go nowhere. So I think this is a good time for questions and comments. If anybody has a question or comment about the ALI, this is the time to raise your hand. You can try it. If your video is on, you can just raise your hand that way, or you can do it. Okay, we've got a person who's raised his hand. Looks like first name of David. David, I'm asking you to unmute yourself. So,
good morning. And again, thank you for doing this for all of us. So I just saw a chat. Someone put it in the chat that this is very disheartening, which is true. However, with the 37 AGs plus the Department of Justice, how is this countered? I mean, how do we flip it and say, okay, all of you are doing this, 30, more than two-thirds, plus the Department of Justice. What's our argument against the 37s? Because this is all about public perception, et cetera.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. By the way, we are writing a letter ourselves, basically supporting the revised model penal code. And you know, folks, all of this is based upon misinformation, dare I say the word lies, and the biggest lie out there is that everybody on the registry poses a current danger. I mean, what? That makes absolutely no sense if you just stop and think about it. But a lot of people don't stop and think. They just react emotionally. And so, that's certainly, and by the way, we have all kinds of studies, academic studies, government studies to back us up. This is not my personal opinion. I've read the studies. I've read the reports. And one of them I love to quote, by the way, in the litigation, especially when I sue the California Department of Corrections, is their own study. So this, the California Department of Corrections own study says that the rate of reoffense, so the rate at which somebody on the registry is going to reoffend, is less than 1%. Think about that. Less than 1%. If there's less than a 1% chance of something happening, you know, does that mean you're never going to walk across the street again in a crosswalk? You know, does that mean you're never going to drive your car again? If there's a less than 1% chance of something happening, of course not. So, so it's ridiculous. And you know, I would hope that the ALI leaders would think about, and as you all pointed out, the people who are objecting, and I think Chance, it was your firm, are prosecutors. Right? Prosecutors don't want this to go away. It's keeping them really, really busy. It's keeping their budgets nice and fat. is keeping, you know, they got a lot of people, a lot of employees out there prosecuting people for things that probably shouldn't even be prosecuted for. So, you know, it's, I don't know, when I worked in for the Air Force as a civilian attorney, the term was rice bowl. So, you know, we basically are trying to take away people's rice bowls, you know, living, their livelihood or whatever. But the fact is, most of these attorneys, if they weren't prosecuting people for sex offenses, they'd find something else to do, right? So come on, folks. So anyway, I think ALI is smart enough to figure this out, but they, some of them anyway, are political animals. And so they don't want to do anything that's just too scary politically. So we'll see how, what kind of backbone they have next month. Stay tuned. Okay, John, you've got your hand up. John, there you go. Do you have a question or a comment, John?
Yes, I was trying to unmute. Thank you. And good morning. And thank you again, both of you, for filing that lawsuit.
You're welcome.
A couple of points are, has anyone reached out to the defense bar and asked them to submit comments on this nationwide?
Yes. Yes. And so, yeah, organizations like the National Association for Criminal Defense Lawyers, et cetera, they've already weighed in. And but I'm sure they're going to weigh in again. Our board member, who's a member of ALI, told us that actually she thinks that the most effective would be letters from organizations that are not directly related to this issue, right? So, you know, criminal defense attorneys directly related, our organization directly related. We should still do it because we want, you know, to be heard, and we don't want them to say, well, we didn't know what you thought, as if that would make a difference. But we don't want them to say that after the fact. So we're going to go ahead and weigh in. But yes, please understand, John, there are a lot of people and a lot of organizations that are weighing in and letting the ALI know that they support the revised model penal code. I mean, they really think about it, folks. You know, a revised model penal code that hadn't been changed for 50 years, and they spent 9 years on this effort, and this is what they came up with, and now they're all of a sudden going to abandon it. I have a hard time thinking they're going to abandon it entirely. And Steve, I know you have your hand up, so, but there's
two. Janice, I have one other point. I have one other question, and that is, did the objection letters specify what points, or just a flat, we reject everything?
As I said earlier, and you may not have heard it, John, I never saw the U.S. Department of Justice letter, so I'm not sure what it said. But as far as a letter from the 37 AGs, I think it was rather generic. It's just kind of like, oh, we know everybody on the registry is scary. And of course, they need to be monitored at all times.
I would invite them to specify what elements of the ALI's report they object to, and then attack those point by point.
Well, hopefully ALI will do that. There, by the way, there are two people within ALI who basically shepherded this through the process. And so I think they have, in fact, been tasked to do that. And by the way, there's not just the revised model penal code. There's all kinds of background information supporting the revised model penal code. So it wasn't just like two persons' opinion, personal opinions, but instead it was, you know, a lot of hard work that went into this. So Heather, I'm going to call on you next, and then Steve, you'll be after that. Okay. So Heather, if you'd unmute yourself, please.
I am trying. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Terrific. I wanted to thank you for everything you do. It's amazing. I provide sex offender treatment. So I have a lot of questions about the registry and the new levels and getting my guys, as I call them, off of the registry. Can you refer me to that information? This might not be the right context to ask about that.
Sure. Well, Heather, we are going to discuss the tiered registry later in this meeting, if you can hang in for it. We also, Chance and I put together a webinar about 2 months ago. The webinar is on there as well. Or if you send me an email, I'd be happy to send you all kinds of information.
Thank you so much. I will get on that.
Excellent. Thank you, Heather. Why don't we do it this way, if you don't mind? Put your email address in the chat section, and I'll write it down and send you an email. We can start directly communicating that way. Okay, Scott, there you go. I'm going to ask Scott now to unmute himself. Steve. Hi, Steve.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi. You're coming in a little broken up, so I don't know if I'm broken up to you, but here goes. I was wondering if anybody ever batted around this argument, is that just how effective is the registration laws? Do they do any good? It seems to me that if anybody was going to do anything, they would do it, whether the neighborhood knew they were there or not. I don't know. I mean, you can mark the guy and clearly see him maybe having activities with their children or whatever, and do something about that. But if somebody's going to do something, then I don't see how a registration's going to stop that. So I don't know if anybody's ever argued that or anything, but that's always bothered me about it.
Well, the fact is, there have been a lot of studies and reports about the effectiveness of the registry, and they've all come to the same conclusion. Registries are not effective. They're just not. And one of our board members, her first name is Sherry. I don't think she'd mind us sharing that with you. But Sherry came up with this great saying, which is that registries give families a false sense of security, right? So the assumption is that everybody on the registry is a monster and they're going to do it again, right? And everybody else is safe. And that's not true. And we know that because over 90% of people who in fact are guilty of sexual abuse are not on the registry. So, hello. So registries are not effective in either direction. Chance, do you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, that's the whole premise of the reformation of the ALI, is that particular argument, mm-hmm. is that they are not effective, and that in order to there, it's a compromise between totally junking them, which is what one group wants to do, and the other group, which wants to keep them, because they think that some aspects of them are necessary. So it's a compromise in between the two. But what you brought up and what you're saying is the whole reason that they've spent 10 years studying this thing. And so anyways, it's, that question is the essential question being asked.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chance.
You're welcome.
Looks like Joe has a question. Joe, if you would unmute yourself, please.
Hello, Joe.
I'm sorry. Great. I did not intend to ask a question. I apologize.
Oh, okay. No problem. You're stretching. Very good. Okay. Well, before we go to the next topic, which is the SORNA regulations, I think it's time to just briefly tell you one more time, or maybe it's for the first time, to mark something on your calendar. So March 2023 is the 20th anniversary of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that has caused great harm to our community. That decision is Smith versus Doe. All right. So in March of 2003, that's when the U.S. Supreme Court decided, literally, that being on the registry was not punishment. So think about that just for a moment. Being on the registry, the requirement to registry, is not punishment. And in fact, and I'm not making this up, they said it was like getting a membership at the Price Club or Costco. So we all know that's a bunch of nonsense. And so what we need to make sure is that the court is aware of all the harm that has flowed from their mistaken decision. So that's why we're going to Washington, D.C. in March of 2023, and you are very sincerely invited to join us. So Chance and I will be there. I assume Joe and Marty will be there. Kathleen, all of our board members will be there at this event in March of 2023. And quite literally on March 7th, of 2023, we will be on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court, and we will have a vigil. So this is not going to be a loud protest. I want you to know we are there to educate the court. We are there to educate the public about what has flowed from that decision. I can just imagine you're an egghead sitting in the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't think any of these folks has ever been into a Price Club or a Costco, quite frankly. So how would they know what it's like to file an application, right? registration is just like that. Well, we all know that's not right. And by the way, because of that decision, right, then they said that it doesn't violate the Constitution to, in fact, pass new laws and apply them retroactively. So that's where so much of this harm has occurred, because a lot of government at every single level, it's a city, it's a county, it's a state, and of course, the federal government as well, they keep passing new laws and they keep applying them retroactively. And so I'm bringing up my friend Frank Lindsay, also my former plumber, one more time. So Frank was convicted in 1979. Guess what? There was no internet in 1979. There was no Facebook in 1979. And so when Frank Lindsay entered his plea of guilty, he didn't understand, because he couldn't have understood that someday there would be an internet, there would be a Megan's Law website, and his photograph and his home address would be on that website. And that's indeed what has happened. So, you know, and because that information has been made public, guess what? Somebody broke into Frank's house and tried to kill him in his own home. You can read about it in his book if you want to, his book called We're All in This Together. But this is the kind of nonsense, and I'm being kind and trying not to swear this morning. This is the kind of nonsense that's flowing from this decision. So we need to go to the court and we need to educate them. Now, would it be great if we could argue a case in front of them? Yes, it would. But guess what? They're not accepting cases right now. And the U.S. Supreme Court takes some small percentage of cases under review every year. And the last time somebody tried was in the case of Doe versus Snyder, which had to do with the Michigan sex offender laws. And the state of Michigan did not like the decision by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so Michigan tried to get the U.S. Supreme Court to review that decision. And the court said, no, thank you. Go away. Okay, so, you know, there's different ways to educate. We could educate in a lawsuit if they would take one under review, or if they won't take one under review, we will go to them. Okay, it's like bringing people Girl Scout cookies, right? Here you go, court. Here are your cookies. Oh, by the way, it's been a bitter pill for us to swallow, and they were not here to poison you at all, but we're here to educate you. So please listen to what we have to say. I also think this will be a great opportunity to educate the public, and I think we're going to get a lot of media attention. So I hope that you all will put this date on your calendar and figure out how you're going to get there. I mean, I think Californians were probably the farthest away from Washington, D.C., and yet I know we're going to have a lot of Californians there. And for all of the rest of you that might be closer, please, please, please start figuring out how you're going to do this. I know one gentleman told us that he was putting, I think, $100 a month away or something like that, and that was going to be his travel funds. We're going to make it as inexpensive as possible. I mean, it costs nothing to go to the event on March 7, by the way, but there's going to be a conference that starts on March 4. So March 4, 5, and 6, a conference, actually the 4th and 5th. The 6th will be on Capitol Hill. We'll be meeting with congressional members and their staff. And then the 7th will be the event on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court building. Pretty soon, next month in March, so in March of 2022, one whole year ahead of time, we're going to basically make it available, sign in. I don't want to use the R word, registration. So we're going to have people sign up for the conference, okay, online. And I believe that will start next month. We're going to ask people to make a small commitment, monetary commitment of $25. It probably will cost more. I guess this is for the conference, not for the vigil. The vigil is absolutely free, but there's going to be some good speakers and some good networking that goes on at the conference before that. And so we hope that you'll come and join it all. So that's probably said enough. But Chance, maybe you can say a little bit more about March of 2023.
I just want to say, join us. It's important that you be there. It's important that we make the statement. It's important that we have a presence and we show a vision as to what the future should be in this country with respect to getting rid of this pernicious registry. And it all starts with this case. So it's time to roll up, make a statement, and get it out so that everybody can hear it. And I'm just hoping that everybody here will be a part of it.
Yes, please, at all. And by the way, bring a friend or two or your family. You know, bring as many people as you can. My vision is we're going to have 100,000 people there. So prepare yourself. Okay, Liz, you have been waiting patiently to ask a question or make a comment.
Yes, I just have a quick question regarding this whole issue of the harm of the registry. How can we, or is it relevant to, how can we most effectively voice the damage done to wives and children? And is that an effective angle, or is that not relevant to the argument?
Oh, it's absolutely relevant, and it can be very effective. I remember a few years ago, it might have been 5 years ago, in Nebraska, that the, I believe a child, a teen daughter of a registrant testified before the Nebraska legislature and caused them to stop in their tracks what they were doing. So you never know, you know, in a specific instance, what will happen to do. But I think that it would be really effective in Washington, D.C. to have family and, you know, spouses and children there at the vigil, I guess I'm saying specifically, because you're right. A lot of people don't think about the harm that flows to families because of people on the registry. And it can be as basic as, you know, when the breadwinner of the family, or at least one of the breadwinners of the family, can't find a job, it affects everybody in the family. It affects, you know, what housing you have, what you eat for dinner, if you eat dinner, right, et cetera. Somebody here, is talking about being homeless. We understand that happened. We have homeless people on the registry. At our meeting just last month at the California Sex Offender Management Board, they reported that there are almost 7,000 people on the registry in California that are homeless. 7,000 people. How can that be? I mean, that, to me, that is just so unconscionable that there are 7,000 people on the registry who are homeless. And by the way, of course, it affects their family as well. It affects their spouses. It affects their kids. I know of some registrants who are living in their car while, you know, in order to provide their family with a home because the family home, you know, is too close to a school or too close to a park or something. We don't have restrictions like that in California anymore, thank goodness. But in many states, there are restrictions like that. And so, yes, there's a lot of suffering going on. This is exactly part of the message that we need to share with the U.S. Supreme Court. Thank you. All right. We have somebody's with the title C.A. Imhoff. Please. Yes.
Hi, Angela is the name, but I couldn't figure out how to change the initials, so I apologize.
No problem.
I'm tuning in from Arkansas. Is that okay?
Absolutely. Welcome. We're nationwide. Yes.
Yay. Okay. So two things. One, I have a question about Washington, D.C. My husband and I travel with our daughter quite a bit, and I think that that's one I try to be pretty studious when it comes to knowing when I travel. Isn't it like within 24 hours of arriving, you have to register?
No, this is the beauty of Washington, D.C. There are actually no registration requirements for visitors. So if you visit Washington, D.C., as long as you're visiting, you do not have to register at all.
That's incredible news to know. We literally changed a vacation because I thought you had to, like, as soon as you touched into the city, check in with the police or something. Okay.
No, and I will tell you very specifically, I talked to the registration office not that long ago in Washington, D.C. on behalf of a client. And what they said was, oh, no, nobody's required to register, but we'd like you to register. And I said to my client, don't you dare register.
Don't do it. Yeah.
If you don't have to, why register, right? I mean,
yeah. Okay, thank you. The other thing was I just want to say you had mentioned the client or the plumber that you had from 79. My offense, I know I'm a minority here because I'm a female offender. We exist, by the way. This isn't just a male mistake. But I accepted a plea agreement because I was told in 10 years you can ask to be off the list. And then 10 years, it was in 2005. And then 10 years came and they're like, oh, we just changed the law last year. Now it's 15 years. And then 15 years is 2 years away. And now, according to what the new SORNA laws are, it's like, oh, now it's 20 years. And it's just so discouraging that they just keep moving the bar back and back and back. And so that has just caused enough anxiety that my family wants to, like, write letters and explain how hard it is that they haven't been forthcoming from the beginning, because I possibly wouldn't have accepted the plea agreement, and I might have fought harder for some of the details of the case to come out, and now here I am. And so anyway, I just wanted to kind of validate how, yeah, that's a stinker, and I appreciate what you do.
And if you think about it, and all the different ways that the registry affects your life, you know, whether you're male or female, and for somebody to keep moving the goalpost and say, oh, 10 years, oh, no, 15 years, and the next, oh, it's going to be 25 years. I mean, there's nothing fair about that. There's nothing reasonable about that. And one of the things that the law is supposed to do is give us all some certainty, right? And so supposedly this is like, I don't know, criminal law 101 chance, right? Like, well, you know, supposedly the person before they do something, they know what the penalty is. And so then they weigh that penalty is whether or not it's worth it then to do the act. Well, how can you say that somebody actually made a decision like that if the penalty keeps changing after the act has already occurred? So anyway, Chance, I'm sure you can embellish upon that. Please do.
Well, yeah, you know, the fact is that most people make, you know, when they are subjectively in fear, make poor decisions for themselves. And what happens is many folks decide to go with the wrong type of attorney or attorney who doesn't have experience. And they're pressured by, you know, this idea that they could be incarcerated for a long, long time versus just compromising and being able to, you know, exercise their freedom at the cost of their future. So my advice and what I would say to those folks who get caught under those circumstances, and for many that are joined with us today, that's too late. But it's important from the onset to find an attorney who's familiar not only with the legal process, a criminal defense attorney, but someone who has a vision towards the future and understands what the implications of registry is all about under the present state of the law. And so, you know, that is really where the rubber meets the road. Anybody can, you know, any criminal defense attorney can, well, I shouldn't say that. Most are able to discern what the elements of an offense are, and maybe they can come to some kind of disposition, some kind of settlement, but very few understand what the real implications are when you have to register and what your life is afterwards and, you know, what the nature of this thing is all about. And unfortunately, all of us gathered here know it, and it's hindsight. Hindsight doesn't help very much when you're steering towards the future and you have to deal with the present. So really good advice. Find somebody who knows what they're doing, understands and has a vision towards the future. And for those who haven't been able to do that, thank God you're here, because we're doing that as a group together. So that's my take.
Thank you, Chance. Spiro, you've had your hand up. Would you like to ask a question or make a comment, sir?
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of as a follow-up to the last question. I'm going to be leaving the States soon to live in the European Union, and I am absolutely planning to be there for the event in Washington, D.C. And you know, I'm kind of trying to plan that out from now. I'm under the impression that I wouldn't want to be in the United States for more than 3 days at a time because of the new SRNA regulations. And you made a comment about not registering in D.C. I was wondering if, you know, how that might apply to staying in D.C. for more or less than 3 days.
I don't think it's a good idea for me to answer that question in a recorded call. So if you would contact me separately when it's not a recorded call, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, sure thing.
All right, thank you. Okay, so I think that's all the questions or comments and all the hands that are up at this point in time. So why don't we move on, Chance, and talk about something really easy like the SRNA regulations. I'm sorry. Okay, so the SRNA regulations have taken effect. In fact, they've been in effect for about a month. They became effective on January 7th of this year. And what we're looking for, I got my ears, you know, wide open here to anybody who's had an experience yet under the new SRNA regulations. As far as I know, no one has had this experience, or they haven't found me yet. Chance, I think that's the same for you, that you haven't, no one's contacted you yet who's been charged with violating these new SRNA regulations?
Correct. That's correct.
All right. So if you all want Chance or I to discuss specific provisions in the SORNA regulations, we will. But I was thinking that today might be really the bigger picture about the SORNA regulations. And I have some potentially great news to share with you. So here goes. There's a very large nonprofit organization that has contacted us and wants to file a lawsuit on behalf of registrants with regard to the SORNA regulations. So this is not something that we're used to happening. To put it mildly, I'm used to the opposite. I'm used to going to a four-letter organization, ACLU, and begging them to take one of our cases and them slamming the door in our faces over the years, 10 plus years now. But this other organization, I didn't even know existed. And quite frankly, the reason they care about this is not so much about they care about registrants, but what they care about is the separation of powers between the three branches of government. So, you know, we're talking about the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. And their going in position is that this is the attorney general basically exceeded his authority when he issued these SORNA regulations. And I don't know about you, but that's music to my ears. It's like, wow, somebody else gets it, right? That in fact, gets it that in fact, the attorney general did something he shouldn't have done. I could have said, if there was a female attorney general, I would say that she shouldn't have done. But the fact is, the attorney general, you know, there is a law out there that tells the attorney general that the attorney general, whoever it is, because it changes, of course, every administration, and sometimes within the same administration, that in fact, you have a certain amount of authority to do X, Y, and Z. But if they don't say X, Y, and Z, you can't do it. And so this organization, and I'm not going to reveal yet who they are, but I think by our next month meeting that they will have made their final decision about whether or not to litigate this issue. If they don't litigate, by the way, Axalt will litigate. But this organization has been around a lot longer than we have. It's got a lot more resources than we have. Including, here's a statistic. And once I tell you the name of the organization next month, you can look it up. But the fact is, they've taken 16 cases to the U.S. Supreme Court. 16. They've won 14 of the 16 cases. So these folks know what they're doing. They're absolute professionals. And we've met with them in Los Angeles almost 2 weeks ago. I flew to L.A. because I'm in Sacramento. I met with it. Two attorneys from that organization and one potential plaintiff. And now this next week on the 23rd of February, they're coming to Sacramento and I'm meeting with the same two attorneys and I'm introducing them to two more potential plaintiffs. So they're taking this very seriously. They're devoting a lot of time and money for travel and such. They are, you know, we're kind of all looking for the Rosa Parks plaintiff, right? So I don't know if you know that story or not, but with Martin Luther King, you know, and the Rosa Parks was not the first person who volunteered to sit in the white only part of the bus. Okay. And to make a big deal of it. And, the Martin Luther King and his, group, said, nope, nope, nope. And then Rosa Parks showed up. They said, yep, you're it. And why did they choose Rosa Parks? She was a librarian and she didn't have a criminal history. So, you know, you as an attorney, you're looking for plaintiffs like that, right? So we have some, by the way, the two plaintiffs that they're going to meet with, potential plaintiffs this week in Sacramento, were both convicted of misdemeanor offenses, okay? And they've both been relieved of the requirement to register. And yet, that under the strict interpretation of this of the SORNA regulations, anybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense, let me repeat, anybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense could, in fact, be required to comply with the SORNA regulations. So I don't know about you, but that sounds pretty scary to me. It's way too broad, no doubt about it, and would have a bloody fight on our hands for sure. One of the two potential plaintiffs next week, one of them, he got himself off the registry under the fishing process just a few months ago up here in Northern California. The other one, he was one of my clients and together we got him a certificate of rehabilitation 10 years ago. And he is very much afraid that he's going to have to comply with SORNA. So whether or not somebody's going to have to comply with SORNA if they're no longer on the registry is a legal issue. I don't want to discuss that now, but what I really, again, want to repeat that there's another organization out there who cares about the SORNA regulations and might be as upset about it as Chance and I, I'm not sure. But anyway, they want to litigate and they think that they have a good chance at basically getting a court to agree that the Attorney General has exceeded his authority. So if anybody has any questions or comments here about SORNA regulations, this is the time to raise your hand. It's easier for me to see you if in fact you use the reactions button to raise your hand. But if you just wave at me or James and I, we'd be happy to call on you. And it can be a comment about the SORNA regulations. It doesn't have to be a question. But here we go. John, you have a question or a comment. I'm asking you to unmute.
Thank you, Janice. Question I have on the regs, are they in effect now or have they been stayed pending any actions that have been filed against them, according to the feds anyway?
John, are you asking the question, are the SORNA regulations effective now?
Yes.
The answer is yes.
Okay, thank you.
So they've been in effect now for about 6 weeks. And so, we're on alert, high alert. Chance and I here are on high alert for anybody to contact us that thinks that they've been, that these new SORNA regulations have been applied to them. So please, if you know anybody, if it's happened to you or you know anybody, have them contact us immediately. And because it shouldn't be happening at all. But if that should happen, we want to help you. If Chance or I can't represent you in court, we can help you find an attorney who can. Ron, I think you have a question or a comment?
Yes, I do. By the way, thank you very much for all that you do, Janice, both you and Chance. You guys are really awesome.
Thank you.
My question is, there are some states that we can travel to where we've got 10 days to register. But I understand with SORNA, that's now been curtailed to 5 calendar days. Is that correct?
I don't have the SORNA regulations in front of me. That number doesn't sound right. But it could be worse than that, unfortunately, depending on what state you're living in. So let me explain. In Florida, I believe they already have a state law. This is not SORNA in Florida, but a state law that you have to report if you're going to be gone from your home for more than 3 days. And under these SORNA regulations, it says 7 or more days. Right. So do you live in a SORNA compliant state? Do you know?
Oh, I live in California. So, and specifically, I'm talking about Hawaii. We go to Hawaii quite regularly and it's 10 days. So we stay 7 and then I avoid the registration that way.
Good.
But I thought what I read in the SORNA regulations was that it was 5 calendar days, as opposed to Hawaii, I believe it's actually 10 working days.
Mm, okay. Ron, I can't answer that question right now without some supplemental material, shall we say.
Okay.
So I'm happy to contact, or if you contact me directly to answer that question for you, I just need to pull up some material.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
You're welcome. I will warn people going to Hawaii, though, in addition to the 10-day limit per visit, I think there's a 30-day limit for calendar year as well.
We don't have that much money.
Okay. Well, that can be a limiting factor, all right? All righty. Thank you for that. And JD, I'm sorry I skipped over you, not on purpose, but things shifted. So I'm going to ask you to unmute right now if you have a question or a comment.
Hi. I'm coming up on what would be my quarterly registration here in California under the new SORNA. And so have we come up with a plan here in California to put pressure on the local registration by showing up and saying, well, it's a SORNA regulation, and let them tell us, no, we're not doing it? And then is there a way to document that?
I think this is a good question for Chance.
I'm happy to answer that. No, we're not. We're not doing anything. We're not putting them on notice that we know. We're letting them give us notice so we know. And that's the whole point. You're in a defensible position, if you don't have notice, it's up to them to give you notice. Okay, if they're not giving you notice, then we're going to proceed the way we proceed until otherwise notified. We're not going to push the issue, because It may be that these regulations, as for Californians, mean little or nothing. And so that's I think the way to handle it is to do what we've always done in California and wait to see whether or not anyone gets notified or they start to implement these things in any way, shape, or form. I don't think we should initiate that type of action.
And I agree with Chance. It's kind of like, you know, do you want to go and pull a lion's tail? Why? To see if it'll roar at you? No, I don't think that's a good approach. And so I think I want to state slightly differently something Chance just said, which is, you know, until you get notification by the government, at least we would make the argument as attorneys, until you are notified by the government that you are required to comply with these SORNA regulations, you're not required to comply with these SORNA regulations in California and other non-SORNA compliant states. Okay, it's different if you're in a SORNA compliant state, I believe. And by the way, some of the things that might happen here too is in fact that you might get notified. And this is one of the things that I'm waiting for, perhaps you as well, Chance, is for somebody to go in for their annual registration. And when you get your document, your registration document, you know how it's 6 pages long already, but if they're going to add SORNA regulations to your registration requirements, that's one way it could happen. How else is the government going to notify you, right? I mean, the SORNA regulations are pages upon pages long. And if the California Department of Justice has told us they didn't have enough money to send you a letter in California telling you what your tier assignment is, how in the heck are they going to have enough money to basically, you know, print out all the SORNA regulations and send them to you? I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's much more likely, and Chance, I'm going to invite you to tell everybody what you think. I think it's much more likely when you go in for your annual registration that at that point in time, they could tell you you have additional requirements.
I agree with that. And it reminds me of the situation with IML, which is when IML first started out, you know, a lot of folks, you know, who were traveling were confused and didn't know what to do. And so they went to the agencies they registered at and they said, you know, here's my 21-day notice. And, you know, the agency said, your registering agency said, what are you giving this to us for? What are you doing? Okay. Well, what we were doing was we were making sure that we weren't the first test case for IML in California. Turns out there was none. Okay. And it turns out that, you know, we're a non-compliant, we're a non-SORNA compliant state. Okay. However, you know, just in the interest of not becoming that first test case, many very wise people gave 21 days notice anyway. Didn't have to. But they did. Okay. That's because international travel is a different animal. Okay. Here with these regulations, this is not a new law that was passed. It's not IML. These are regulations coming out of the Attorney General's office. Okay. That are, you know, extensions of SORNA, which may or may not be constitutional. And, you know, until they're implemented in a way that they can be challenged, we won't know. But, you know, that may not happen in California. It may happen in some other SORNA non-compliant state. Might happen in some SORNA state. Who knows? But, you know, at this point, I think we should just all relax and see where this starts to, you know, starts to creep out. And I'm not sure it's going to creep out anywhere. I mean, we have how many people in this meeting right now? We've got 81 people roughly in this meeting. How many people have registered recently and have been and have a whole different registration scheme or new boxes to check or been advised about SORNA? Raise your hands. Okay, Ron, what do we got? We got two raised hands here.
Well, they already had their hands raised, Chance.
Okay, so we got no raised hands here.
Oh well, here's Tom.
Okay, Tom, maybe we can get some feedback here and see what what's what.
Okay. Tom, I'm asking you to unmute.
Okay. I'm unmuted. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I was taken off the list and received a set aside for a misdemeanor just recently. And I would like to come visit family in California.
Okay, I'm not sure, Tom, what you're talking about. Taking off what list and what?
Well, taken off the registry. I'm off the registry in my state, and my conviction for a misdemeanor has been set aside.
Okay, so how is SORNA affecting you?
Because my the date I was taken off the registry was February 8th, and SORNA went into whatever law as of January 7th. So I was a month and a day short, but I'm still, I believe, covered under SORNA in a SORNA compliant state. And my former registering agency said, we don't know. When you travel or go to another state, you might get swept up and slapped in the can and charged for whatever crime it might be for non-registration of SORNA in that state.
Okay, so you're in a SORNA compliant state?
Not completely. No, we're not.
What state are you in?
Michigan.
Michigan. Okay, that's great.
Messiest state.
We're in one of those maybe states, and or sometimes compliant, sometimes not, and we don't we here in Michigan, we just really don't know what the flipping laws are. And
yeah.
I was under our newest law, which took effect, I guess, last March. I was, just by chance, I was one of the few, because I've been on the registry forever, seemingly, that I was able to fall into the crack. And I go like, dang, and we gotta let this guy off. And I'm very happy to be off, and I don't have to pay my $50 registration fee.
Cool.
And I don't have to register. I don't have to start dodging cops or anything like that, although I do. And I swear they all know because they're following me around town. But that's another story. That's just paranoia.
Okay. So Michigan's a mess. But thanks Michigan's for letting us. But thanks for letting us know about that. But who else is there? Tim Moore here? Tim Moore has his hand up.
Two bits of good news. I got off the registry in California in fall, and right after that, I found out my daughter was having a baby, and I'm going to be a grandfather. So my question is relating to SORNA. She's in another state. If I go visit her, am I going to be under SORNA regulations, or how does that work?
Okay, so that's you're unfortunately you're not in the question groove here. What we were asking for is, has anybody been notified or impacted by these new SORNA regulations? Has anyone received any notification? Has it impacted you in any way? That's what we're talking about right now.
Okay, so it's just put my question in a file there for later then. Sorry about that.
Yes, I'm looking at the chat room here, and at least one person has said that he went to register this year and nobody gave him any additional restrictions. I've seen other people who have registered in the last 30 days who have not gotten additional restrictions. It's not to mean it won't happen, but so far, keeping my finger crossed here that it doesn't appear to have happened yet. But I will say something about IML and the 21-day notice. In California now, in the annual registration, it does tell people now, if they're going to travel overseas, that they have to give the 21-day notice. And that's a strong reason that I think that if these additional SORNA regulations are going to be implemented in California, it's going to come through time of annual registration. So we're on high alert, as I said, folks, about that. And we're very sincere, Chance and I, in saying that if, in fact, you have an experience like that, just don't wait for a monthly meeting. Contact us right away. So I know that Angela has been waiting here very patiently. Maybe she has something about SORNA regulations. Maybe not. Angela?
Hi. Can you hear me okay now? Actually registered 2 weeks after the SORNA had to do my every 6 months, 2 weeks after it went into effect. And okay. In my county, I said, hey, now that there's new SORNA regulations, I'm going on a spring break trip. We used to go to Florida. We don't anymore for the week. Now we like carefully, tactfully plan 2 days in this state, 3 days in this state, round robin, like we road trip it for protection. But do I have to tell you guys, because I'm going to be gone for more than 7 days? And all of them in the office were like, we don't know anything about that. We don't, we're clueless. Like, I'm thinking you guys are the ones that actually are responsible for me, if that's how you want to word it. And they didn't seem to have a clue. And so then I'm left like frustrated. I mean, I just, she said, just do the same things you've always done unless we notify you. I just feel like maybe because of how traumatic all of this stuff was, moving forward and asking forgiveness after the fact seems like isn't the best move for me, because we've all lost our grace options. But I hear you, Chance, saying, no, no, do that. And so I hear you and I appreciate it. And also it causes me just a tiny bit of anxiety to consider that, because I read a lot of those laws and I don't know. I guess I want assurance from you that if I accidentally mess up on something that I didn't know I was messing up on, that I'm not going to get in trouble for that. I don't know.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from, but, you know, look at the box where Tom's staring at you. That's Michigan. Unfortunately, that's what happened. People panicked and they started litigating in Michigan. Now it's a freaking mess. But I think that you emphasized our point, which is, you know, you have not been notified and therefore do as you usually do until otherwise notified. And also my take is that the Department of Justice is the one that's responsible, not the law enforcement agencies or anything else. They're instrumentalities. The Department of Justice regulates all this. And so they're the ones who are supposed to get their act together and notify everybody else as to what requirements need to be adhered to. And that's generally what you see on those boxes you initial and read when you register annually every year. So we're waiting to see just exactly whether or not this is going to happen. The indicators for me that, you know, this may just not happen is that, one, no one's been notified, and two, the DOJ hasn't come out and posted anything on its website, and three, in these management meetings, these sex management board meetings, no announcement has been made as to, you know, these new requirements and regulations and what needs to be done. You're not hearing it echo anywhere. And so I'm, you know, hoping and praying that, you know, we're not going to get to that point. But, you know, let's see what the future holds. Janice?
Yeah, I agree with Chance in the near term. And and I hope that it's also true in the long term, that people in states that are not SORNA compliant never have to comply with these new regulations. But we really have to wait and see. And, you know, if you think about, again, the litigation that I was describing earlier, this anticipated litigation, that it's this whole thing about, you know, separation of powers. I mean, it just seems so basic. And like we all learned in, you know, high school, I guess, about civics or government, whatever type of class we took, that there are supposed to be three separate branches of government, and they're all supposed to have checks and balances on each other. And this is one of those examples. So, you know, if you look at this one way, I see this is a big picture. So the federal government, for ever since 2006, so we're now we're talking about more than 15 years, the federal government has tried to persuade states to adopt SORNA for more than 15 years. And in 15 years, only about one third of the states decided to become compliant. So, they were using a carrot, not the stick, but they were using a carrot with the states and saying, oh gosh, gee whiz, if only you become SORNA compliant, you too can apply for these federal grants. We're going to basically give you money. And states like California did a rough estimate and they said, there's no way. It's going to cost us so much money, more money to comply with SORNA than we could ever get in a grant program. No thanks. Thanks, but no thanks. And there's some other reasons as well. So what these new SORNA regulations do, quite frankly, is they basically try to leapfrog over the states, over state governments, to the individual. And now they're trying to tell individuals over who they probably don't have any jurisdiction. So separation of powers here. They don't have any jurisdiction over you, right? If you're in a non-SORNA compliant state and you weren't convicted in federal court, et cetera. So that's what they're trying to do. And I'm too bad, federal government, if you're frustrated by this. Too bad you couldn't convince the states to become SORNA compliant. Maybe you should stop and wonder why it is the states don't want to become SORNA compliant. Because these regulations, quite frankly, are not reasonable. And by the way, they would cost state and local governments a lot of money, right? So state and local government that are non-compliant states, they don't want to do this. The question is whether or not their hand will be forced to do it. And so that's why, we understand. I mean, trust me, I understand. I have a lot of compassion for people who are on the registry and worrying about these sort of regulations that are now basically orbiting around your head and wondering how they're going to affect your daily life. We understand that. I think they have a huge chilling effect on people's daily lives. I mean, even the simple one about 7 days, do you have to tell somebody really if you're going to be away from your home for more than 7 days, even if you're going to stay in the same state? A lot of people in California do that. You know, they've got family. They live in Southern California. They have family in Northern California, vice versa. And it's not no big deal to go spend a week with your family. Well, under some of these new SORNA regulations, it could become a big deal, and that you would have to tell local law enforcement where you live that, oh, by the way, I'm not going to be at my home for 7 days. Right now, who cares? There's no requirement whatsoever to tell anybody that. But under the new SORNA regulations, there is. So we're, you know, sitting there. I mean, Chance and I are sitting there. I feel like I'm on alert waiting for somebody, you know, to get basically hit on the side of the head or worse, you know, with the SORNA regulations, get charged with, convicted of a crime involving these new SORNA regulations. They're relatively new. They've only been in effect for 6 weeks. So I'm hopeful, but not necessarily optimistic that they, you know, that the federal government won't try to prosecute somebody like Mr. Nichols, right? Mr. Nichols, who decided to leave the state of Kansas. He was fed up. It was Kansas. He said, I'm moving. But he didn't bother to tell the state of Kansas. He just packed a suitcase one night and moved to the Philippines, which he had every right to do. And guess what? Our federal government got him extradited from the Philippines, dragged back to the United States involuntarily, and then, you know, tried to convict him, did convict him of violating some law. But the U.S. Supreme Court said, guess what? He didn't break any laws. The state of Kansas did not require him to notify the state of Kansas before he left. And so guess what? The feds lost that case. But in the meantime, what happened to poor Mr. Nichols, right? I assume he went to the Philippines for a good reason. And yet he was dragged. I can just see fingernails, right, from Philippines back to Kansas. And you know, he was dragged back to the United States against his will. And it took years to get to the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. And even though he ultimately won, I don't know. If anybody knows Mr. Nichols, would you ask him to contact me? Because I really would like to know. I hope that he had a good life despite all this nonsense and that he felt good about winning that case before the U.S. Supreme Court. But who knows? But folks, Chance and I are here to help you guide you through the minefield. But we need two-way communication. So if any of this, all of a sudden you're told, guess what? You now have to come and register 4 times a year instead of 1 time a year here in California or anywhere else that's not a SORNA compliant state. Let us know. You know, Chance and I can help you in California. We have attorney colleagues in other states as well. And there's other organizations that are specific to a state, like in Illinois. And one of our former board members, Adele Nicholson, who's a great lawyer, and she's in Chicago. And so anyway, I just referred somebody to her this week because he's from Illinois. Okay, somebody's been waiting here, and he's on the phone, he or she. Last 3 digits are 840, so if you would unmute yourself, and I don't know how you do that on a phone, but I'm clicking ask to unmute, so please unmute yourself if you can. Okay, I just don't know if technologically possible. Oh, there we go. Hello, sir.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Also, with this whole thing that's going on, I'm kind of nervous as well, because I'm currently on parole in California. Uh-huh. And my registry is in May. And you're saying, you know, I haven't been notified by my parole agent or anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm nervous about going back on a violation, especially failure to register. So do I just go on my regular registration date, or do I contact my agent? What would I do?
Well, I think because you're on parole, you might be in special circumstances here. And yeah, if I were you, if you were my client, which you're not, I would recommend you ask a parole officer. And you'll probably get the answer, what? What are you talking about? What do you think, Chance?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, you want to contact your parole officer, and rather than say, you know, to ask them, you know, hey, you know, here's these new laws, take a look at them. I would just ask them if there's anything new you should know before registering. And if they say nothing, or they tell you no, I think you're cool. And then you go down and you register as you always do. I think that's the simple solution.
Okay, I'll give it a shot. But, you know, again, it's kind of makes the anxiety go up there.
Well, you're going to take down your anxiety when your parole officer tells you no. You just do what you always do, and then you go down and do it. So that should take away your anxiety.
And so I hope you all hear the distinction.
Thank you guys very much.
You're welcome. I hope you all hear the distinction here. So the gentleman who just called in is on parole, and so he's in a different category. And so people on parole have to be extra special careful, we understand that, to comply with parole conditions. And so to me, in weighing the balance here, remember I said about pulling the lion's tail? Yeah, he probably does need to pull the lion's tail, ask his parole officer about registration. And as long as the parole officer says, you know, just do what you've always been doing, then I think he's covered that way. So we've got another caller here, William. I'm asking you to mute yourself, sir.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I'm currently on supervised release for a federal case, and I recently registered last month on January. And I asked the office where I registered if there were any changes from SORNA, and they just looked at me like I didn't know what I was talking about. And he said, we didn't receive any notification of what you need to do or anything like that. And also, I asked my probation officer the same question. And she goes, well, all you have to do is just look on the stuff that you have to sign an agreement. And it says that even though that I am a federal case, that I still have to comply with the state. The state supersedes federal. So that's how she explained it to me. And that's kind of how I've been proceeding it so far.
And that is the way to do it. That's exactly the way to do it. And that's you've now covered yourself. You've now asked the questions. You now are in total compliance because that's what you did. And it's especially important in your case because you have a federal conviction, which is, you know, more in line with SORNA regulations, rules and regulations. So that's good.
Okay, I think we've asked or called on all the people who had their hands up. At least one time we've called on them. Here comes another one. John,
Janice, just one comment. It's kind of like with my own personal case where I had a parole agent tell me that one thing was okay, and then when they did their Halloween raid, they said that what was authorized by that parole agent wasn't okay, and he turned around and was afraid to stand up and say that that's what he'd agreed to. Basically, was saying that my girlfriend could have booze in the house and I couldn't drink it. And that was fine because I wasn't drinking. But point being is that there was nothing in writing to justify or to verify what he had told me. My suggestion would be anybody who is trying to get any information, do it in writing. And if you're prohibited from being on a computer, have your girlfriend, your wife, some friend of yours do it in writing on your behalf and get an answer in writing from them. So you've got some paper evidence of what they actually told you, because they'll have a memory lapse real quick. Like what happened to me. Anyhow, thank you.
Yeah, that's actually good advice. Thank you, John. Yeah. And again, what he's suggesting is if you do go to your parole officer, your probation officer, and ask them a question, ask the question in writing and get an answer in writing. That would be great. Okay, so we've got the next issue is going to be the tiered registry law. Before we go there, I want to make another announcement here about the event in March 2023. I know a couple people have signed on since we talked about it last, but March 2023, we're going to be in Washington, D.C., and we hope that you and your friends and your family will come join us on March 7th. It will be on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. By the way, we've already notified the court that we're going to be there at the District of Columbia, and they don't have to approve. We just have to notify them that we're coming. And so the stage literally is being set. And it's really, really important to get as many people there as possible, because we need to get the attention of the court as well as the public about the mistake that the U.S. Supreme Court made back in 2003. So I'm going to leave it at that. Please just add it to your calendar again in March of 2023. So the next issue we're going to talk about is the tiered registry law chance. Would you like to start that?
Well, okay. Well, this pertains to Californians, of course, and I'm sure now by now everybody's aware that California has moved from a lifetime registration type state to a tiered registry state, which means that there are off-ramps, some, not all, but there are off-ramps. So, for instance, if you are registering now and your conviction lands in off-ramp number one, which is the 10-year off-ramp, after 10 years of registering, you can petition to be removed from the registry. Some folks land in the 20-year zone, the 20-year tier. That's an off-ramp. And you can apply, and if your petition is granted, you can be removed from the 20-year. And then there are those who are in Tier 3. Not everybody in Tier 3 is stuck in Tier 3, but most are. There are some Tier 2 people that are in Tier 3 because of risk. And if you can show that that risk now has been mitigated and you really belong in Tier 2, you can be moved down there and removed eventually by petition. But otherwise, most folks are stuck in Tier 3. So we have three tiers in California. That's the tiered registry. And there's a lot to know about it in terms of petitioning off it. But the basics are 10 years, 20 years, and lifetime, unless you're up in lifetime because of risk and you're really a Tier 2. Janice, where'd you go? There you are.
Okay. Just grab a little snack. Thank you. So yeah, the petitioning process has started here under the tiered registry law in California. And I have a couple of reports. And I'm reporting information from the San Diego County. And so, so far since July 1 of last year, they have filed 143 petitions. And of that total, 69 have been granted. So that's about half. Only 11 have been denied, and the rest are still pending. So of the 11 that were denied, four of them were denied because of a summary. It was a summary denial. Basically, the folks weren't eligible. And then seven of them, it was because of public safety. And certainly, Chance and I have some really strong opinions about what that means, public safety. I know that I've taken four petitioners forward, and four petitions have been granted so far in three different counties. I will say what they have in common is that in each of those cases, the DA did not object to the petition. So that is really important. I have one next month in March where the DA has objected to the petition, and we're going to have an evidentiary hearing. We're going to do a lot of work for that registrant to prepare the judge and hopefully let the judge know that this person does not pose a current risk to society. And oh, by the way, community safety would not be enhanced significantly or otherwise if he continued to register. This is somebody, by the way, who's on Tier 2. He has registered for 26 years. He had a clean criminal history record before his registrable offense, and he had a clean record after that. So if this guy doesn't pass muster, I don't know who does, quite frankly. But I think it's position of the DA in that county that they don't want anybody to get off, I guess, though other people, anybody convicted of a felony to get off. They've already approved one misdemeanor petitioner. He wasn't my client. In fact, he did it himself and he did a good job. So he got off the registry. His petition was granted. But I think the case I'm referring to is only the second one in that county, and the DA's office is objecting to it. So there's been, you know, and Chance, I know you've successfully represented folks on who've been petitioning as well. So I will just say overall, not as many people appear to be submitting petitions as we might otherwise expect. In other words, I think there are a lot more people eligible to petition who are not petitioning yet. And I think there's a variety of reasons. And one of them, I think, is just waiting to see what happens to other people in the courts. So I don't know, maybe. So if you guys have any questions, or women, any questions here about the tiered registry, the petitioning process, or anything else, please raise your hand. Steve, I see you raising your hand.
And Janice, before we start, I have some good news to talk
yes,
about.
Yes, please.
And the good news is that many folks thought that if you had, if you were on the 20-year tier and you had like a 288A, you know, that was going to be immediately turned down. I have good news for you. People that I've represented that have had that charge are being removed in places you would never expect. So that's good news. And the other thing is a lot of people are discouraged because they have they've gotten a designation from the DOJ to be determined. Janice is right. You know, the secret sauce here is trying to get over that DA's objection. I had an objection in a to be determined case that ended up in Los Angeles County. I got over that objection by pointing out that we don't need a designation to look at the reports ourselves and see whether or not a person falls into a particular tier. And the good news about that is that the court granted that, even though it was to be determined, and the DOJ recently removed that person from the registry without classifying them. So it can happen. It is dependent on the jurisdiction. There are some jurisdictions that, you know, will be resistant. There's some that won't, but don't let that discourage you from petitioning, because it is completely possible. And it depends. It depends a lot on your individual situation, but don't be discouraged. There are positive signs here, and we're moving forward. So with that, questions.
Yeah, I will add that three out of the four petitions that have been granted for my clients, they've all been convicted of 288A, lewd or lascivious acts under 14. So that's not an obstacle. The DA's office is an obstacle, possibly. Okay, Steve, you've been waiting here. You have a question or comment, sir?
Hi. I was just wondering about what do they look at? What is the criteria? Let's just say for computer pornography, child pornography. What is the criteria they look at for levels of, like, I was flinned down to four pictures. In New Mexico, they had me on a lifetime. Then I moved up to Washington just recently, 4 months ago. Is that something I'd have to call you about?
Well, for one thing, Steve, we're talking about the tiered registry in California, so I don't think any of this applies to you. Are you planning to move to California?
Oh, no, what? But but when I moved up here, I registered, and that I'm still waiting for them to level me. They have three levels that they are adjudicating to put me at. I haven't been informed about what they are yet.
I'm certainly not going to answer that question because I'm not licensed in that state. Chance, do you want to say anything about it?
Well, I mean, the basis of our conversation here is California. So let's.
Oh, okay. You know, all right.
Yeah. I mean, and if you have questions about your particular situation, probably better suit it for a personal phone call.
Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Steve. John, I think
your
you're back.
The question I have, again, is that when you guys talk about the cases,
yes.
Could you specify which county you're talking about? I don't need the names. Just let us know which county gives a better reference point for our own petitions coming up.
Okay. I will say, I can just talk about my experience. Contra Costa County, in the DA's office has been very, been straight shooters. It's not that they always agree with what I have to say, but they let me know what their position is. And that's really valuable. And so the one case that I was talking about earlier with the gentleman who's registered for 26 years and is on tier two, that's Placer County. I'm having trouble with that case in Placer County. I'm also having trouble in Contra Costa County. I said, yeah, they're straight shooters. They'll tell me what they think. But a gentleman who, in fact, was convicted of misdemeanor offense, the tiered registry law says anybody convicted of that offense is on tier one, and he's certainly been beyond the 10-year requirement and no other offenses. But the fact is that the DA's office will not, has objected to that petition just because he hasn't received a tier designation by the California Department of Justice. And by the way, yesterday when this issue was discussed, at the Sex Offender Management Board meeting, it got a lot of attention because it's really, really a major obstacle in most counties, in that either, you know, the DA's office will not consider the petition, local law enforcement won't consider the petition, the court won't, you know, is going to grant summary denial because, again, just for lack of a tier designation. And I personally think that's wrong. And, you know, I'm have an ongoing conversation, shall we say, with the California Department of Justice about this. And they did change two things. They changed their letters that were being sent out. It used to be when somebody got a letter that said your tier is to be determined, that it said, oh, and this means that you can't petition for removal. And I wrote a nice lawyerly letter to them and they said, well, we're not saying we agree with you, but we're going to take that sentence out of the letter. And so they did. So that was a minor victory. But I've heard from more than one DA's office telling me that the California Department of Justice told them that they cannot process a petition if there's no tier designation. And yet, Chances had an opposite experience in one court in Los Angeles. So there's not uniformity out there in these TBD letters. And I think just like Chance, I would encourage you, even if your tier has not yet been designated, to go ahead and file a petition. Okay, David, you've been waiting. I'm asking you to unmute yourself, sir.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, everyone. I'm here in California, and I have a friend that just went to register, and they gave him the letter to be off the registry. So they told him to do the petition for that. So he's been awarded. They told him that he can get off. But my question is, if you're a tier three, I'm a tier three, is there any remedy or you just have to live with that?
So David, is your conviction for possession of child, or does it have anything to do with child pornography?
No.
Okay. And well, you know what, let's not do this on, in a recorded message. So would you please contact either Chance Oberstein and myself? I would suggest you talk to Chance.
Sure.
Okay.
Can I get your phone number, Chance?
And one thing, yeah, just a comment about that. There are those that are in tier three because their offenses are tier three offenses, but there are some people in tier three that are in tier three because they have a tier two offense, but they are considered a high risk. And so, you know, the answer to your question is that some people can be removed from tier three if that risk level is shown to be other than what it is that elevates them to tier three. So, you know, and that's worth a call and a discussion privately. So that's the answer to your question.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, David, for your call. So it looks like Angela is waiting to ask a question or make a comment. Angela?
Yeah, you bet. I have a quick question. I've been in the state of Arkansas now going on almost 15 years. And I mentioned earlier, they keep moving the bar back. It was 10, 15 in the state you've been in. And we've talked about moving to San Diego a few times, but the conversation my husband and I always have is I'm in a, if you want to call it what I call it, an offender friendly state, or at least an offender more polite state, and California wasn't. And now that it has the tiers, my question is, if I move to California, does the clock start over? Or is it from my conviction time? Like, do I have to then be in California for 10 years on the California registry? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And the answer to that question is no. It's not, it doesn't start all over. It used to. On the old remedy, it used to be if you were in California, left California, came back to California, it rolls over, and there was no relief for out-of-state convictions. In this particular situation, it is the number of years you have registered, and it's
wherever I've been.
Yeah, and it's dependent on what the conviction is and what the equivalent is here in California.
Angela, were you convicted in California? I missed that.
No, I was convicted in Missouri, and my minor was over the age of 15.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's over the age of, well, anyway, talk to Chance. Okay. Yeah. But probably
worth a private, you know, a private
consultation. Phone. Yeah. And Chance was talking about a different process that existed before. You made a brief reference to it, and that was a certificate of rehabilitation. So, the law is different now. So under certificate of rehabilitation, a person had to be here for 5 years prior in the state before they could petition, but there's no such requirement under the new tiered registry law.
There's something that happens sometimes. The sheriff that I checked in with regularly had encouraged me multiple times in my state to possibly get removed. And so that's when I went and they moved the line and moved the line and moved the line. But when I did, there was this always this threat that they give that you have to retake a lie detector test and get reevaluated. And they kind of say, and then they might move you up to a higher number or something. There's like this fear tactic, I think, that gets used. Then I go, oh, maybe it's not worth it. I should just stay where I'm at. But is that something in the state of California that they kind of require you to get reassessed? Does that make sense? I don't know if it works same, but we have definitely considered moving to California.
No. California is just not like that. You know, and what's nice about California is that, you know, it has to do with objective factors, and there's no fear factor, which means they don't put you through a process, you know, a witch hunt in order to determine whether or not you're eligible.
There's nothing like that in California. So
I would love to call one of you. I just didn't know this. Can I get a phone number or something like that?
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Chance.
You can call either Janice or I, but if you want to call me, you can call me at, I'll post, you can post the number in chat or whatever.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
As far as I'm concerned, that was psychological warfare, what she was talking about in the other state. And if Arkansas is doing that, I think they should be sued. So.
Agreed. Anyway.
Okay. We've got a person named Bryn, a woman, she, her, female named Bryn. Bryn, I'm asking you to mute.
Hi, I have a question regarding actually finding out your tier. My husband has been trying since January 2021 at the police department that he registers at, and every single month he goes in and he asks, and they say they don't know, they're not sure when they'll know, and if we ask, is there anywhere else we can get this information, we go to the courthouses, they also say they don't know, so we're kind of like lost on what to do next.
Okay, so I'm going to guess, Bryn, that your husband's tier has not been determined yet.
Okay.
It's just a guess. However, even saying that, that office owes your husband a letter, a tier assignment letter, even if it says to be determined. So I'm going to give you my phone number, and I'm just going to blurt it out here because everybody has it anyway. My phone number is 805-896-7854. Again, 805-896-7854. There are some misguided registration offices out there and misguided registration officers who are playing hide the ball, and they deserve to be to get their attention, whatever we have to do. And I will say, I don't even stop. I go, if I have to the California Department of Justice and report them, because they have to give you the letter. The California Department of Justice has put letters for every single person in the registry in a government-only database. And that database is called CSAR. So it's an acronym, C as in Charlie, S as in Sierra, A as in Apple, and R as in Romeo, CSAR database. Oh, by the way, only the government has access to this database, so Chance and I can never look at it. But that's where the California DOJ dumped all these letters in that database, and the registration offices all have access to that database. And so all they have to do is press a couple of buttons and then, you know, click for print and get the tier designation letter. So even if your husband's tier has not been determined, they can provide him with a letter that says your tier has not been determined. Okay. And folks, this is a grave injustice that's being done in California. I mean, first, California DOJ should have mailed a letter to every single person on the registry saying this is your tier designation. And believe it or not, the people there in that agency said they didn't have enough funding to do that. And I mean, I don't even have to think about it. Just like California is the fifth largest economy in the world, not just the nation, but in the world. And this is a state agency. So that's nonsense. Of course, they have the resources to do it, if only they'll spend the resources doing that. So instead, what they did is they shifted the burden to the registrant that you have to go to your registration office, right? And beginning during COVID, I mean, we're still in COVID and maybe an endemic and not a pandemic, but the fact is that you have to keep bugging your registration officer to ask for your tier registry, your tier designation letter, when it should have been mailed to you. Ah, that makes me more than a little crazy. And so for anybody, any jurisdiction to deny you that letter, they need to hear from an attorney and or the California Department of Justice. So don't even hesitate, folks. If you're getting that runaround, let me know and I will address it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm going to care about that a lot. Okay, so I don't see any more hands up right now. Folks, this is your last comment. If you have a question or a comment about the tiered registry law, other than that, we are going to move on to military retirees. Oops. Nope, that's okay. That was Brent's hand.
Janice, I see two hands, but maybe they've been up already.
Yeah, they've already spoken. Bryn was the one who just spoke, and the 840 has been up there for a while. Folks, if you could take your hands back down, that would help us so that we can know for sure that you've already been given an opportunity to make a comment or to ask a question. Thank you. Okay, we've got one left there. All right. So, So let's go to military veterans, military retirees being denied access to military bases. A lot of people have gotten very unpleasant surprises, and that's a mild way of saying it, in that they've gone to a military base that they've been able to access for years, maybe decades, and found out all of a sudden they can't get on base. So, I'm a veteran myself. I'm not a retiree. I have no reason to go on a military base any more than any other member of the public, but our retirees do. So, you have an identification card. I believe many people were told, from the very beginning of the time of their service, that they would in fact be able to go on to military bases, to go to the exchange, go to the commissary, the gas station, the movie theater, sometimes even for housing. And yet all of a sudden this policy changed. The policy changed on November 1 of last year. So all of a sudden this door came slamming down and a lot of people are being told now they can't get onto military bases. Now, we've been doing some research, legal research on this topic, and it's a bit of an uphill climb, but the fact is we are planning litigation. And so my legal assistant and I have been conducting legal research and also consulting with an attorney in North Carolina. And so it appears from the law that the strongest claim a military retiree has is for medical access to medical care. But there's also, at least it's my opinion, it's worth fighting about going to the commissary and exchange as well, because that's what a lot of people have done for many years. That might be a benefit rather or a privilege rather than a right, but the medical care is a right. So I will tell you that ever since this issue came up, we have gotten, EXAL has gotten so much input from folks all over the country. So this is not just happening in California at all. And it's happening regardless of military service. So it's not just the Navy that's doing this or just the Army that's doing this. It seems to be nationwide and it seems to be just happening. And by the way, so what am I talking about? And I made reference to a policy. So there's a policy out there and it is in writing. And it basically says anybody who's currently on a registry cannot have access to a military base, right? And I mean, that's shocking. And by the way, the policy also says that everybody's going to be notified about this prior to the policy taking effect on November 1. And as far as I can tell, nobody was given any notice whatsoever. So how do you find out? You drive to the front gate of the base, and all of a sudden, you're denied access. And many times not even given a specific reason. Now, in some of the bases, they're telling people that there's an appeals process, but the appeals process, quite frankly, looks really, really long and convoluted, being kind. Now, I will tell you, there's always exceptions to the rule. So here's an exception. I had a military retiree who's on the registry contact me, and he was a cancer patient, and he was being treated for his cancer. And all of a sudden, they told him he couldn't go on base. And we didn't go through the formal appeals process for him. I was fortunate enough to finally track down the judge advocate general on that base. And she was horrified. And so she went to the base commander and got this person access to the base. But you know what? That's really unusual. For other people, they're starting to submit, or they have submitted an appeal in writing asking for permission. Oh, here's another one that I was able to get help for. A gentleman who had an RV and a boat that was parked on a military base, and he wanted to take his boat and his RV off the military base permanently, and they wouldn't even let him on base to do that. So I was able to help him out too, and he got a one-time pass to be able to do that. So I know there's a lot of people here who have different circumstances, but I want you to know that as an organization, we really care about you and we want to stop this nonsense. And again, I'm being kind and trying not to swear before noon. But hey, it's getting close to noon. So anyway, maybe we should open it up now for questions and comments. I see you there, Kathleen. I'm sure you have something you want to share with the group here about your experience. I'm going to go ahead and unmute you or ask you to unmute. Yeah, you're going to have to unmute yourself. Sorry, Kathleen. Not yet. No, we still can't hear you, Kathleen.
Okay, I couldn't, excuse me, the unmute icon wasn't coming right up. I finally got it. Sorry about that. Well, first of all, I have not been stopped at the gate. God, as I've said so many times before, I got a very friendly hello, greeting, smile from the young man at the gate. I've gone in and out of the various facilities, the exchange, the commissary, the package store. And for those of you who are not retired military, that's the liquor store. And no undue attention, same as always. However, I did hear a comment or read a comment that even some dependents, which I am, a 28-year DEP wife, that means dependent wife, were being refused access. I would like to know more about that. Will that be happening to me one of those days? These days, I don't know. But I will say this, and I've said this to Janice and to the whole board, I believe that if my husband had worked for almost 30 years for a civilian company and been contracted to get all of these benefits upon retirement, I don't think they would have jerked him away like our dear government is doing. Right. And I also think that given that my husband's crime occurred almost 20 years after he retired from the Navy, that there's something really hinky about this, because his benefits were earned during the 28 years he served actively in good standing in the Navy. Right. I guess that's pretty much all I have to say, unless you have a question for me.
Well, I guess I would like to put your comments in perspective. So Kathleen is a dependent wife, and her husband, who is the retiree, he's the one who has been denied access to military bases, right, Kathleen?
Exactly.
Okay. Joe, I see your iPad there. I don't know if he stepped away or not. Okay. Joe, there you are.
We can see you from the nose up.
Yeah. You're sinking into the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yes, the San Francisco Bay.
Hi.
Hi, Joe. So would you mind sharing a little bit about your circumstances?
Sure. Was not, but as I got to the gate, they asked me to pull over to the side, took my ID card, kept it for 10-15 minutes, and then said,
Joe, unfortunately, you're breaking up here. I'm not sure why. Yeah. Okay. So, Joe, I'm going to mute you. No.
I'm breaking up. Let me move to a different position.
Okay. Thank you.
Get out of the water.
Oh, I know why.
Quickly, I'll just think. Oh,
okay, Joe.
I know why, because I had to move around and I set it up on my mobile hotspot and I'm getting farther away from my cell phone, and that's why it's breaking up. Let me go back and get closer to my cell phone.
Okay.
So anyway, they weren't going to tell me anything, and finally I asked, is this because of something that happened in 1992? And he said yes. And they finally did give me a paper and said, use this information to petition for reaccess.
Joe, can I suggest you turn off your video?
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm getting dizzy.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. So at any rate, the petition process, according to that letter, could take anywhere from 4 to 7 weeks. As a retiree, I have a lot of mixed emotions, because as a retiree, I've been part of the military community since I was 21. And if you go back to ROTC in college, add 4 more years to that. And when you've been part of the military, and of course, Kathleen and her husband a lot longer and many others longer than I, but at any rate, you tend to get very attached to the military. And so we like to associate with military people, and we've grown used to the benefits and things we have. So it's quite a shock to be barred from the base and from the things that you're used to doing.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that, Joe. I've been consulting with Joe now for several months, and Kathleen as well. I know their stories fairly well. And one of the things that I want to say is, even though Joe was given an appeals process to follow, I know you said weeks, but I thought it was more like months, that it could take up to a year to get a decision. You know, folks, it's just untenable. So just because you appeal at one base, right, does not necessarily mean you'll get access to a different base. And the fact is, if you're a retiree, I believe you're a retiree, and you should have access to everything in each of the bases. So one of the things, I'm bringing this up in the context of the litigation, and so part of the litigation, we're going to say, well, having an appeals process at one base and getting access to one base does not solve the problem, because guess what? You might be traveling, right? And you might need to go to a military base, whether it's for medical care or go to the base exchange or the commissary, you know, whatever it is, and that you should not be denied that access. So, again, I just want everybody to know Axel is very much aware of this issue, and we're going to be, I think, litigating soon. It's a little bit more complicated than I thought it would be, including, you know, choosing our Rosa Parks plaintiffs, of course, but it's going to be happening sooner than later. And here, there's a gentleman named David. I'm asking him to unmute. He's got his hand up. David, do you have a question or comment about this issue? David, ask him to unmute. So far, he hasn't unmuted. I know he spoke earlier, so I don't think his hand is from up from that point in time or not. But anyway, we'll continue. I've asked him to unmute, and if he unmutes himself, we're getting applause, I think. Okay, thank you, David. Maybe because they're willing to weigh in on this issue. But you know what, folks? This is just the kind of example. And, you know, Joe, I mentioned what year it was that you were convicted. Now I can't remember, but Kathleen, you said your husband, John, it was more than 20 years after he left the military and stuff. And, you know, folks, I mean, come on, give me a break. What you know, where's the connection here between what, between your conviction and whether or not you should have access to a military base? And it really is based upon, you know, this myth. And no, I don't have a lisp. This myth that everybody who's on the registry poses a current danger. And we know that's not true. And, you know, one thing is like, okay, if you want to exclude somebody from a military base and you want to do it on a case-by-case basis because this person does indeed pose a current danger, we wouldn't be opposed. But the thing is, it's just like this blanket restriction all of a sudden that, oh, if you're on the if you're on the registry, you know, you're dangerous and we don't want you here. And you know, I'm very sympathetic to what Joe said. Kathleen, I'm guessing, you know, you have similar thoughts and feelings, which is you're part of a not really a club or an organization, but a community, right? The military community. And then all of a sudden you're being shunned. And again, given no notice, given no way to get back into the club or whatever, to back into the community and being held in good standing. So again, I just want to tell folks that we are in fact taking this very seriously, and we're going to do our best to weigh in. And I also see, and neither Joe nor Kathleen mentioned this, but I think it bears mentioning, and that is this whole thing about a slippery slope. So I don't know if you all know this or not, but most people on the registry now cannot be buried in a military cemetery. And I'm like, what? And there's a rumor out there. I've not heard it as to be a fact, but I'm going to repeat the rumor that somebody who was a registrant had already, you know, died, had already been buried in a military cemetery, that he was taken out, disinterred from the cemetery, you know, after the fact. And I'm like, what the heck is going on here, folks? I mean, the fact is, what, you're going to reach out from your coffin and grab a kid's ankle or something? I mean, this is just freaking ridiculous. So, and then the other thing about the slippery slope is, what's coming next? Are they going to try to basically reduce or eliminate your military pay, you know, your retiree pay? You know, I think that's unlikely to happen, especially in the near term, but we lawyers, we talk a lot about, right, chance, slippery slopes. And to me, this is a prime example of something that could happen. So again, you know, as an organization, I want all you military retirees to know we're taking this very seriously. And your dependents, by the way, Kathleen, we're taking it very seriously, and we're going to do our best to restore your rights. So we're here for you. Chance, I'm looking at the time. We've spent a good 2 hours with the folks, and I don't know about you, but I think I'm complete. And so why don't we remind everybody that if, in fact, we're getting anything of value today, whether you're listening to this recording or not, we really appreciate your making a donation to the organization. It's really easy to do that using our donate button on our homepage online. So one more time, it's www.all4conslaws.org. I hope most of you know where our website is. It's real easy to send us a donation electronically. If you want to mail a donation, we have a new mailing address. So the new mailing address is 2110 2110 K Street, Sacramento, 95816. Again, 2110 K Street, no floor, by the way, Sacramento, 95816. In case that address sounds somewhat familiar, it's the same street, K Street. It's a different number. It's 2110, and it's a different zip code by one digit. So it's 95816. I'm not even telling you the old ones because it'd be too hard and too confusing. So in closing, again, I want to thank you all for being here. I'm glad to participate in this as a volunteer and to share information with you. And looking forward to seeing you next month. I will be back on March 8th. So Chance, why don't you wrap us up here if you don't mind?
Well, I will. And thank you very much. You know, I just want to reemphasize something Janice said, and that is donate, please. Our organization leads the nation in this fight, and you are part of it. And two things we would ask of you. One is get more folks to join. And two is give as much as you can to keep this fight going. And I just want to thank you, and I appreciate you coming today. And we look forward to seeing you in the future. And just thank you so much.